When I was not long out of the cradle, some of my earliest memories were of my mom and her guitar. She had a singing voice like Joan Baez and a repertoire of old folk songs. I was raised singing along to lines like "The Fox Went Out on a Chilly Night." A decade later, when I first picked up one of her guitars and learned to play a D chord, it was her Pete Seeger instruction record and her collection of early Bob Dylan albums that sent me on a path towards being a songwriter. If that wasn't enough, Elizabeth Brooks was a librarian and a city councilwoman who shaped other lifelong loves like reading, writing, and social justice. I miss the hell out of her every year around Mother's Day. She never got to see where I would take those early influences because she was taken by breast cancer when I was 24. There's another reason that I regret that I never got to know my mom as an adult. My junior year in high school, she and my dad decided to split. It was seemingly out of the blue. Over the years, I picked up bits and pieces about their hidden history. It was enough to realize that they had been living a big lie for a long time. But I never got to hear her side of the story. She didn't much want to talk about it, and I never will. So I've always been a bit envious of anyone who can greet Mother's Day without mixed emotions. I love my mom dearly, but decades after her passing, I still have the nagging sense that I didn't fully know her. Try as I might to understand the family that made me, the jigsaw puzzle has too many missing pieces. To fill them in, I've done what writers do. I have looked to stories, stories about other families. And there are two families that have particularly drawn my attention. Leave It to Beaver and the Book of Genesis. Perhaps some of you have had similar feelings. If you grew up from the 50s through the 70s, chances are good that you were exposed to both of those great archetypal families, the Cleavers and the Children of Abraham. And chances are good that your own childhood fell somewhere on the long line between those two extremes. Like all archetypal stories, both Beaver and Genesis express profound human truths, even though their truths appear utterly at odds. For that reason, I like to think that those ideal parents and their families can help us to make sense of our real ones and all of their glorious and maddening contradictions. When we think back on June and Ward Cleaver and their two mischievous sons, it is tempting to view them down our postmodern noses. They're an impossibly proper couple, a dad who wears neckties at home, and a mom who vacuums her spotless house while wearing pearls. It's a bit creepy that the perfect mom and dad have no relationship with their own parents, any more than they appear to have any social lives outside of the home. In their own time, though, the Cleavers were doing something revolutionary. They were talking to their kids, and more important, they were listening. Rather than laying down the law, Ward Cleaver reasoned with his sons about moral principles. Many commentators have described the show's debt to Dr. Benjamin Spock in his 1946 book, Baby and Child Care. Writes psychology blogger Katie Dempsey, "This show was basically a primer for modern parenting at a time when people still held the view that children were just really annoying and needed to shut up, sit down, and stay out of trouble." For baby boomers, much of the attraction of Leave It to Beaver was that Ward and June were the well-adjusted and understanding parents that we all wanted to have. The problem was that they were fictional characters. For many of us, our real parents had a hard time measuring up. When my folks threw in the towel, I spent a lot of time wondering what was wrong with the Brooks family. From where I sat, most of my classmates' families looked as normal as the Cleavers. I found it oddly comforting then when I first read the book of Genesis. If the Cleavers are an icon of the functional family, the clans of Hebrew mythology were icons of the opposite sort. They start with fratricide, and they go downhill from there. Abraham sires a son with his wife's slave girl. Then he casts both mother and son out into the desert to die. His grandson, Jacob, cheats his brother out of his inheritance. A generation later, Jacob's offspring sell their brother into slavery. As the book of Micah sums it up later on in Old Testament history, a man's enemies are the men of his own house. It's not just the Bible, of course. Greek mythology makes Genesis look like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. The god Zeus slays his own father after his father has eaten several of his siblings. The great Greek tragedies from Oedipus on down are all family affairs. Our oldest stories are telling us that there is something dark and scary about our ties that bind, and that families have been dysfunctional from the beginning of time. Without them, there would have been no material for Shakespeare or Dostoevsky, William Faulkner or Tennessee Williams. Not to mention, there would be precious little to read while standing in line at the supermarket. I can't tell you whether a dysfunctional upbringing makes a person appreciate King Lear or the Brothers Karamazov. I suspect, however, that it accounts for much of the popularity of The Simpsons, South Park, and Family Guy. What's going on here? From a child's eye view, these tales of family slapstick help me to blow off steam. I laugh at Homer Simpson because I spent so much of my childhood thinking that my dad was self-absorbed and clueless, and because I knew better than to tell him to his face. On another level, these stories help me to recognize patterns that I couldn't see growing up, like the taboo on acknowledging that the family has serious problems. King Lear rewards the daughters who observe the taboo and punishes the honest one who won't. I can see the consequences, from communication breakdowns all the way to civil war. But I get a more primal satisfaction from these stories, a sense that I'm not alone. It makes me feel better to realize that many of my classmates' families were guarding their secrets just as jealously as mine. It reassures me that if I wasn't blessed with the happiest of childhoods, I'm no less normal than the kids who were. As novelist Claire Lezebnik writes, "No one's family is normal. Normalcy is a lie invented by advertising agencies to make the rest of us feel inferior." Now, let me be clear. When I say I wasn't blessed with the happiest of childhoods, I'm not complaining. I received many gifts from my mom and dad. I've never had kids of my own, so I've never faced the challenges that they did. In retrospect, I'm keenly aware that they sacrificed much of their own happiness for what they believed was the good of the kids. The one gift that they couldn't give was emotional support, probably because they weren't supporting each other. Looking back, I can see that we had a foundation of love in our household, but in real time, it was buried under so many layers of anger, suspicion, and fear that I couldn't feel it. What I could feel was that something was missing. Somewhere in our psyches, I suspect that each of us has an innate sense of our ideal family. We know which of the needs our real families met and which ones they didn't. But we never really give up on those needs. Instead, Once we become adults, we invest a large part of our energies in seeking other ways to meet them. Thankfully, the last few decades have expanded our options. There's a large literature on dysfunctional families and a wide variety of therapies to help us grow beyond them. Pop psychology has given us the character of the inner child and the idea that we can be our own parents, lavishing ourselves with the kind of TLC that the first pair couldn't fully manage. Writes counselor John Bradshaw, "As you learn to champion your inner child, you can find nurturing people who will give you what you needed then and what your inner child needs now in order to grow." His words have rung true in my own experience. Therapists have helped me to uncover old wounds, but what has done the most to heal them has been a discovery that I wasn't stuck with my family of origin. I could supplement it with families of choice. My malnourished inner child could be fed by people who were related by spirit rather than by blood. I was in my late 20s, and I was living in New Orleans when I met the Christos family. They had formed a New Age commune on Villa Ashby Island, 70 miles down the Mississippi River. It was a location of spectacular natural beauty, surrounded by salt marshes and seabirds. The traditional Villa Ashby greeting was a hug. And as the clan mother remarked, her first encounter with me was like hugging a piece of cardboard. But my reserve didn't last long. Within a weekend, I felt that I had found my people. Over just a couple of hours, I could discuss philosophy, catch a swim in the bayou, and sit down to spill my joys and sorrows over a cup of coffee with a sympathetic stranger. I was joining an extended family that could mend my heart as readily as it could fix my car. We all knew we had each other's backs. Not only that, but I could be appreciated for exposing parts of myself that I had never dared to show at home. Unaccustomed as I was allowing myself to give and receive unconditional love. If my birth family had made me, my family of choice would remake me. Writes actress and author Tori Spelling, "We are not defined by the family into which we are born, but the one we choose and create. We are not born, we become." The Christos were hardly an ideal family. They had their share of crazy cousins and skeletons in their closets. They eventually abandoned the whole island in a family squabble. But the love was genuine, and so was the healing, which extended even to my family of birth. I was able to share the island with my dad and my brother. I also adopted a spiritual sister and a spiritual mom and dad who encouraged me in my heart's desire to quit my day job, devote myself to music, and move to Texas. Since I have lived in Austin, I have collected other surrogate families. In one, I attend annual reunions at the Kerrville Folk Festival, where I hang out with extended family members like some years Meg and Todd Hoke. For 25 years, I have celebrated Easter and Thanksgiving with another tribe known as the Waifs and Strays. I have been present to see my chosen relations into this world and out of it. In a way, I'm lucky that I have found so many surrogate families so consciously. In the wider world, we often seek them subconsciously. Besides trying to create ideal families through marriage, we project our family dynamics onto larger groups. Take politics. Linguist George Lakoff traces conservative ideologies to a model of home that is run by a strict father figure. Liberals, by contrast, view government as a nurturing parent. We can see a similar kind of divide in religion. The Old Testament paints Yahweh as a strict father who punishes disobedience severely, Well, the New Testament offers us a forgiving dad, more of a Ward Cleaver. In between, we find our churches. On the one hand, we haul all of our family baggage right into our pews. Unitarian Leadership School taught me to analyze congregational conflicts as family ones. It described how we as church members tend to reenact old roles from our families, and how that tangle of relationships can keep us stuck in frustration. The flip side is that our congregations give us another chance to identify our baggage and set it down. When we make covenants with one another, we remind ourselves to observe them. We have an opportunity to settle some of our old sibling rivalries. Writes UU minister Meg Barnhouse, churches are like families. Present are the relatives who drive you nuts, and the misunderstandings that hurt, and the destructive behavior. At church, you also get the warmth, growth, shared history, support, love, joy, and pain, just like in a family. This morning, I've discussed several different models of family, but I believe they all offer us a common lesson. For better or worse, families are like oxygen. We just can't live without them. As human beings, we seem to have an inborn need, not just for one-on-one relationships, but for being part of an intimate group, an interconnected web of love and support, of competition and contention that sustains itself over time. If we're not satisfied with our original families, then consciously or not, we create new ones, striving to nudge them ever closer to our ideals. Each, in its own way, can help to fill the cups that our birth families left half empty. Each is part Genesis and part Leave It to Beaver. So, on this Mother's Day, let us sit at the welcome table. Let us celebrate our families, for better and for worse, in sickness and in health. Or, as we say in the South, bless their hearts. We can love them, and we can hate them, and there's no shame in doing both. But, in the words of novelist Tom Robbins, each of them holds out this promise. It's never too late to have a happy childhood. Or, as another iconic mother put it, that would be Mother Teresa. The way you help heal the world is you start with your own family. Happy Mother's Day. Thank you.